Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to the World Soccer Talk podcast. I'm pleased to present an interview with NBC Sports' John Champion, the legendary commentator who's covered World Cups, the Premier League, Major League Soccer, and much more. Here you go.
All right, John. So on a personal level, what was the experience like living in the US with your family? And now you're back in the UK, obviously working for NBC Sports, calling some of the biggest Premier League matches every weekend.
Yes. Yeah. So it's very nice to be back because this is home. But I had five terrific years in the US. In some ways, I'm sad that it wasn't longer. Because when I signed up, I signed a five-year contract with ESPN. And I think in the full expectation that probably ESPN and MLS was a partnership that was going to move forward for a fair amount of time to come. So a little sad that it was cut short, but equally, I've got so many memories and very fond memories of my time in the US and of meeting so many new people, of having to learn a league completely from scratch, of being embraced really by people in the soccer community across your vast nation. So I have only really got fond memories of the whole experience. And it's something that I'm just so glad that I was, if I say brave enough to do, that makes it sound like an awfully difficult decision. It wasn't. But I did have people over on this side of the pond saying, why are you going there? At the stage that I did. So I had to fight those inner demons, but I'm so glad that I did it because I've now got something on my resume that virtually no one else has doing what I do. And I feel better for it, both as an individual and as a broadcaster as well, because the way of doing soccer on TV in the United States is wildly different to the way that it's done in Europe. And so I had to adjust and learn those techniques. I had to become a face as well as a voice. Mm-hmm. So all of that, I'm just immensely grateful for.
So you have the best of both worlds. If I remember correctly, you live in the Cotswolds area. Yes. In the UK, and then having lived in the US, working for ESPN, of course, what are some of the things you miss personally about the US now that you're back in living in the UK?
Well, on a very self-indulgent note, my favourite bar. So I lived in a place called Brookline, Massachusetts, where the golf course is. So 3 miles out of downtown Boston, which was a city that my wife and I, my youngest son, who came to finish high school in the US, quickly learnt to love. And to start with, I was there on my own for 6 months whilst my son finished his school year and my wife stayed with him over here in the UK. And so I was sort of looking for local contacts and friends and place to go and have a decent beer. And I found a place called The Abbey on Beacon Street in Brookline, which I think is run, it's run by an Irish guy who's been in the US for 30 years, a mysterious Irish guy who I don't think I ever met in 5 years, a very regular custom. But I was sort of embraced by these people and they were big soccer fans. So that was my sort of go-to place. So the first thing that I miss about the US is that. The second thing I think I miss is the travel, which may sound a bit weird, but I rather miss getting on a plane at Logan Airport in Boston every Friday, flying to the other side of a vast continent, calling a game and coming back 3 days later. I got into those rhythms. I enjoyed the travel. I enjoyed seeing the great cities of the United States. So I miss that too. And once I start to get a break in my schedule over here, I'm sure I'll be back in the US touring around and meeting old friends. So I miss that. I miss the can-do attitude, Chris. Mm-hmm. I like the fact that in the US, if you've got a glass of beer in front of you, and you're halfway down it, it's regarded as being half full, whereas here it's regarded as being half empty. And it's just a way of thinking, but I think it's representative of that American dream that in the US you can in theory achieve anything and do anything. And it's quite nice. There's no tall poppy syndrome that I experienced in the US, whereas if you are seen to have succeeded in whatever field in the UK, there is a tendency of people to try and knock you down. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the US, they just celebrate you and the people around you for what you are, what you've done, what you can give, what you contribute. And I miss that attitude too.
So the transition from calling it MLS games for ESPN to the Premier League and calling games for NBC Sports, obviously we hear you now and again in the past, and even currently, right, in terms of like some other matches like League Cup and other matches. Yes. What's that transition been like in terms of and your experience working with NBC Sports for the Premier League this season?
Well, working with NBC Sports has been great. It's not an entirely new experience for me, in that before I left in early 2019 to go to the US, I'd worked for Premier League production since its inception. And from 2013, when NBC got the US rights, they were the major client of Premier League production. So although in that 6-year spell up to 2019, I wasn't working directly for them very often, I was contributing to their programs, and Pierre Moussa, their coordinating producer, would frequently be in touch asking me to contribute to one of their documentaries, maybe over something historic in the Premier League, or maybe to do a stand-up from pitch side before a game. So I had those contacts with Pierre and his number two, Adam Littlefield. So I knew what NBC were all about, but obviously I'd been out of that environment for 5 years in the US. So coming back, I've had to learn to work a bit harder, because there are more games to do. So my schedule now is calling the top game on a Saturday for Premier League productions to go right around the world, and the top game on a Sunday and occasionally on a Monday for NBC. And then, as you rightly identify, I still have a relationship with ESPN whereby I'll call the Carabao Cup and the FA Cup when those rounds come round. I also have a contract with Amazon Prime Video in the US. They have two rounds of the Premier League, and then in a year's time they take on board part of the UEFA Champions League, and hopefully I'll be doing the Euros for ITV next summer. So there's lots of constituent parts to my life now, whereas before I just waited for a paycheck once a week from one employer. Now I'm genuinely freelance and having to send out invoices and boring office things like that, but it's great fun, and it's been easier to slip back into this than it was to go to the United States into a completely new environment, because it's like putting on an old slipper again coming back here.
So both you and Peter Drury call some of the biggest games in the Premier League. Have you had any experiences working with Peter in the past, other broadcasters, or any other stories in regards to that?
Just a bit, Chris. Yeah, I mean, we are amongst each other's oldest friends. So although we've been seen as sort of competing broadcasts, and I suppose by many people as rivals for many years, in fact, we get on tremendously well. And that goes back some over 30 years. So when we were both starting out in local radio with the BBC together, so I was lucky enough to get my first staff job out of university with BBC Radio Leeds, city in the north of England, 200 miles north of London. It was just at the time when Leeds United were becoming good again, having been the side of the late 60s and early 70s. They'd had a long fallow period, fallen into what's now the Championship, then the second division. They had a manager called Billy Bremner, who was a famous Scot, who was in charge when I took this job at Radio Leeds. And then he was followed by Howard Wilkinson. And in fact, Leeds United went on to win the last Football League title before the Premier League started in 1992. So I was there in the late 80s. I left at the end of 1989 to go to BBC Radio Network Sport in London. It was then Radio 2. It's now Radio 5 Live. And at that point, I'd become very friendly with one of the other young broadcasters there, Miles Harrison, who went on to become the voice of rugby on Sky Television and is currently out at the Rugby World Cup in France on behalf of ITV. And then when I left, they took on a young broadcaster by the name of Peter Drury, who I'd got to know in the previous months because he was very keen to get into broadcasting. He was working for Haters News Agency in London at the time. And so we go back to then, yes, 1989, 1990. Over the years, we've worked for the same organisation on occasions. So we called the 1996 Champions League final in Rome together, Ajax and Juve, for Radio 5 Live. Then we worked together at ITV for the best part of a decade. Then we were colleagues on the Premier League World Feed. And now, happily, we're colleagues again. So I'm able to see far more of him and him of me than has been the case for the last 5 years. We're godfathers to each other's children. And in fact, here's a little insight into our fairly humdrum lives. Next Wednesday, both of us have great reason to thank David Pleat, the former Tottenham manager, for many things in our careers. He was one of the very best co-commentators that either of us have ever worked with. And David's now 78. He's not been in the best of health, but happily he's improving again. Still working for Tottenham as a scout and going to all sorts of games. And so Peter and I are taking him out for lunch next Wednesday just to go over old times. So it's lovely to be able to do things like that again.
Out of curiosity, I mean, Ian Dark has done boxing for many, many, many years. Have you ever done any commentary outside of soccer?
I have, yeah. I mean, I did three Olympic Games for the BBC, doing the swimming and the ceremonies. I did 3 years of a programme called Test Match Special, which is a famous cricket radio show in this country, which is much loved. I did Wimbledon. I did the university boat race, the rowing. So I have a wide range. I've done two Rugby World Cups for network television in the UK. That's Rugby Union, the 15-a-side code. I also did a Rugby League World Cup for the BBC. So the old multi-sport programme that they had called Grandstand. When I was a young football broadcaster coming through working with John Motson and Barry Davis, two of the greats on Match of the Day, also to fill out my schedule, they used to give me the Rugby League to do because I came from the north of England, which is the heartland of that particular game. So quite often I'd call a First Division or latterly a Premier League game for Match of the Day on a Saturday and then be going to somewhere like Widnes or Wigan or Warrington. Most of them started with W, to call a Rugby League game live on the TV on a Sunday in my early years.
Interesting. So just recently, of course, the VAR controversy in England. I mean, the one example of many, but the Spurs against Liverpool match. And one thing we learned as viewers was that oftentimes that the commentators in the ear can actually hear the kind of the decision in terms of check complete from the VAR officials.
Yeah.
Does that happen in Major League Soccer also? Or is that just the Premier League, as far as you know?
The Premier League is pretty good at giving you a feed. You only get half of the conversation, though, Chris. I should point that out. You're only allowed to hear the VAR talking to the referee. So you don't hear the referee's response to the VAR. And on that subject, it's been very interesting. The last two games I've done, I did Fulham-Chelsea Monday of last week, and then I was doing Arsenal-Manchester City on Sunday. And on both occasions, I had the bleed of the VAR, and the language has changed beyond recognition over the last 10 days. It's much more concise now. There's no room for any doubt in terms of what they're looking at, what they're looking for, and what the conclusion is, and the communication of the decision at the end. It's almost like they're reading from a scripted template. So it's changed an awful lot. It's a lot less matey than that tape that we were all privy to last week from the Tottenham-Liverpool game. So that's changed. But no, we were given good insights into VAR with Major League Soccer, but we didn't have the VAR in our ear. But what we did have was a lot of communication from Howard Webb when he was running the Referees Association in the United States, and a commitment for openness and transparency and a willingness to put his hands up on behalf of his organisation and say, we got it wrong. And that's what we're getting in the UK now, which I think is welcome. But I think it's awkward for Howard because he's still working with people that he inherited from the past regime. He hasn't really had long enough to get everyone thinking in his way yet. So there are bound to be some bumps in the road. And goodness me, last week was a major one.
Yeah. I'm curious, do you miss putting Taylor Twellman in his place as the brash American?
Oh, dear me. I mean, whether he's a brash American or not, I just miss putting Taylor Twellman in his place, whether that's on the television, in an airport, in a bar, in a restaurant. It became great sport. He, in all seriousness, though, he was one of the major reasons I went to the US. So my relationship with ESPN originally was A, calling Premier League games in the UK when they had a UK arm and UK rights. And then the first thing I did for the US arm of ESPN was the 2014 World Cup. And that was when I first met Taylor. And allied to my little contract for doing that was coming over to the US and doing some of the summer soccer friendlies. So I toured round after the World Cup with Taylor and got to know him really well. And it was then that he was agitating, saying, look, come and work over here. And it took 5 years before it happened. And he and his family, they lived just outside Boston, and they were just so welcoming. So I think two or three times for Thanksgiving, when I was on my own in the US, I spent Thanksgiving with the Twellmans. They were wonderfully kind, and he was very generous in terms of opening up his contacts book so that I quickly got to know all the movers and shakers in the American soccer scene that I needed to know. So I've got a lot to be thankful to him for. But part of our fun traveling around the country was winding him up because it's just too easy.
Yeah, and it was fun for us, the viewers watching the matches, listening to the commentary, hearing kind of that banter back and forth. In some ways, it's interesting too, because it's almost like two opposites attract, right? Kind of you as a witty, dry, humoured English person of, you mean, much experience. Taylor's kind of the brash American, kind of quick-witted, but also from a completely different path.
Chris, let me help you, Chris. You're saying that he's cool and I'm not. And that's basically where we're getting to here. But I suppose, yes, yeah, maybe opposites do attract. But he was one of the very best that I've worked with. And I think, you know, we've seen on Apple, haven't we? We've seen on the Apple MLS project just how important and integral Taylor is. You know, when he's in that studio, it's a different place on the odd occasion they've had him in. When you listen to him doing a game, he's absolutely on it. You know, no one is quicker that I've worked with at picking up a potential offside, particularly in the VAR era, where what you're seeing in the moment is not necessarily the whole story. He's wonderfully quick and perceptive at picking up those moments. So it's very easy, I think, for people rather snobbishly to listen to an American COCOM. And this used to make me quite angry, actually. I'd read critiques of Taylor and people having a go at him, really on the basis of his accent. And that it's crazy, because if you listen to the content, the accent shouldn't matter. If you listen to the content, he is terrific.
Yeah, especially the way he reads the game too. And after times, he's almost predicting what's going to happen before it does happen.
And Chris, he knows the TV world. When his career was finished at 28 by the issue with serial concussions, not only did he embrace the charity that he now runs, the foundation, in terms of promoting knowledge and wisdom about head injuries, particularly in sports, and how they should be dealt with and how sports people should be protected if they've suffered one of these. But he also decided, right, if I'm going to do telly, I'm going to do it properly. So he went and learnt the nuts and bolts of a television outside broadcast. And what's particularly impressive is you turn up at any ground around the country, and our crew would vary. There'd be a core crew, five or six cameramen you'd see every week. The sound guy, DC Tom from Texas. We always had DC. We'd know him, but he would know the names of all the crew, Taylor.
Yeah.
And he would greet them warmly, and they would be equally warm back to him, because he cared about it, and it shows.
Yeah, the very first game he was a co-commentator for ESPN was San Jose Earthquakes against Tottenham Hotspur. And I remember like writing something or tweeting something, and I got an email back from him, like, tell me more, like, why do you think this? Why do you think that? So over the years, he's been very, very open to kind of feedback and criticism or just opinion, just so that he can understand what others think, which is a great quality, which is a lot of people wouldn't do that. I'm wondering too, so opposites do attract, but where do you get your witty, dry sense of humor from? Is it family, television, you know, English culture? Where is that from?
You're asking me to sort of self-analyze, which is always a very uncomfortable place to be, Chris. I really don't know. I suppose, I mean, people do say to me, you're very English. And I think they mean it in a nice way. I'm not always sure, but I do quite like that dry, understated humour. That's the stuff that makes me laugh. If I go to a comedy club, or I go to, you know, the Apollo Theatre in London, which is famous for its comedy, and watch a show, it's that dry, understated humour that makes me roar and fall out of my seat. So I'm not suggesting mine is anything like that level, but I suppose that's what appeals to me.
Yeah, because sometimes I'm listening to your commentary, laughing to myself, you know, as far as watching the match, or just laughing at the humour, and then thinking like Monty Python, Fawlty Towers, you mean, kind of.
I love that porridge,
yeah, porridge, yes, Minister,
Polly Parker. Yes, right. yeah, all of those things and several more. That probably dates me as well, Chris, because all the things you're talking about from the 1970s and 80s. I'm not that old, but you're making me feel it.
So. After ESPN and MLS and before NBC and the Premier League, there was a period of time where you were kind of in between. And from what I understand, you traveled the United States, going to Major League Soccer games, not for work, but for pleasure. Mm-hmm. What was that journey like? It was always some of those experiences, and where did you go and why?
All over the place. It was great. It was lovely to be able to watch a game with a beer for once. I went to Minnesota a couple of times, so it's quite a sad time for Adrian Heath at the moment, having lost his job, but he's a long-term friend of mine, so I would go and see him, and my wife Anna would come along, and we'd go and see him and his wife Jane in their lovely home on Lake Minnetonka. Where else did I go? I went to Portland, I got to know a guy called Steve Schroeder, who's the club doctor at the Portland Timbers, who is the most magnificently generous host and is a wine buff. And I'm not a wine buff, but he introduced me to the vineyards of Oregon. So we had a great trip there. I enjoyed going down to Nashville to see people there. I was sort of partially responsible for Tony Husband coming over to work in this country. In that Nashville were looking for a commentator 2 or 3 years ago and asked me if I could put them in touch with anyone that I thought might be interested. And that's a relationship that's grown. So we went to see him and his wife and took in a game there. So yes, we dotted around the US. It was lovely to go without, not the pressure of work, but without knowing that you got to spend the previous evening in a hotel room doing your notes.
So what about, so your club, your childhood club, still a supporter of York City FC, lots of changes in the last probably decade in terms of leaving Bootham Crescent, going to a new grounds in the National League. So now being back in the UK, are you getting to go to York City matches a little bit more than you would have done in the past?
I will do. I haven't been this season. I took in a couple of games at the new stadium at the tail end of last season when I happened to be over in the country. And it's very nice, but there's no comparison with the old one. The old ground for listeners and viewers that wouldn't be aware of a club as lowly as York was a place called Bootham Crescent. And York is a historic Roman city. And the centrepiece of York is its beautiful cathedral, the Minster. And Bootham Crescent was only 10 minutes walk from the central point, the Minster. So it was a very sort of sociable ground to go to in that there were lots of pubs along the way. York is also famous for having a pub for every day of the year. My formative experiences were watching football at Bootham Crescent. So in my lifetime, I've seen this tiny club beat Arsenal in the FA Cup. I've seen them beat Manchester City in the league. Think of that. A side in the National League now beating the current treble holders in a league match as supposed equals. I've seen Manchester United beaten in a cup. I've seen Chelsea beaten in a cup. I've seen Everton beaten in a cup. So I've got wonderful memories of that ground in particular. And it was also where I saw my first ever professional football match back in the mid-1970s as a boy in short trousers. So to be uprooted and moved to an industrial park 4 miles outside the city is quite a harsh experience. But I'm just relieved that the club's still going. Because like so many clubs at that level, it's had its moments where its very existence has been threatened. I remember nearly 20 years ago organising an event in York and getting Steve McLaren along, because Steve is another native of York. And at that time, he was riding high at Manchester United on his way to become the England manager, which, as we know, didn't turn out so well. But we had a big function to raise money to keep the club going. So it's come a long way since then, but they are in the fifth division. There are new owners who I'm hopeful of, because they've got deep pockets. I just hope that they know what they're spending their money on and how they should spend it, because I'm rather alarmed to see that in the National League we have a first team squad of 36 players at the moment, which strikes me as probably twice as many as we should have. But I think they're still bedding in, the new owners, so we'll see.
Yeah, it's interesting how the National League has become very attractive in terms of, even from the US, in terms of people following it, interested in the clubs, whether it's Dorking Wanderers or even previously Wrexham or Notts County, York City. I mean, I think a lot more American soccer fans can name teams in the National League than they could have done a couple of years ago, thanks to Wrexham and their documentary.
Yeah, there's very little, if anything, to choose between the standard of League Two and the National League. And in fact, many players in the National League are probably better players and are better paid than those in the league above, because there is such a chase for success and for promotion out of that National League that there will always be two or three owners every year throwing serious money at the situation. But what you do get with football at that level, in this era where the Premier League sucks so much out of the environment of football because it takes so much of the attention, if you go to a National League or even a League One or League Two game, you can still, the phrase I use is, you can still taste the Bovril and you can smell the liniment. Because those are the two formative experiences I remember from my first ever football match, walking past the back of the main stand at York City on the way to watch them play Newport County in the old fourth division. And I was handed a drink, which was this horrible beef drink called Bovril, which, as you would know, is very popular at the time in the UK. And then as we walked past the back of the stand, you could see through the windows into the dressing rooms. And this smell, this violent smell of sort of Ralgex, came out of the open window, and that was the liniment that the players were rubbing on their limbs ahead of the game to keep them supple and avoid injury. So I think if you go to the National League, you still get those basic experiences. It's football you can feel and you can touch. It's not glamorized at all.
The last question I have is about your experience commentating top flight English football through different decades. Obviously, the VAR controversy has been pretty hardcore in terms of the level of just frustration. But in previous decades, has there been anything else like this that has caused so much strife or so much... I mean, you get kind of two crowds, kind of those who want to get rid of VAR completely or those who want to keep it but maybe fine-tune it. But can you think of any other controversies in terms of it affecting the game itself in previous times?
Not in the same way, Chris. But I mean, I have lived and worked through the era where English fans were banned from Europe, for example. Right. So issues such as that. And when I first started broadcasting in the 1980s, it was a dirty thing to say you were involved in football. It was the time of the Thatcher government. I think she would very happily have probably closed the entire professional football industry down if she could have done. A lot of grounds were playing with fences around them. A lot of clubs were playing with fences around them. So the fans were treated almost like prisoners within the grounds. You walked out of a football ground in fear of what might happen, particularly late at night, whether you'd get embroiled in some fight. Going on public transport to and from football matches was not a clever thing to do in those eras. So there was almost an existential threat to the game then. So this is pretty minor by comparison, but it's no less annoying. And you said quite rightly that it's a polarizing issue. There are two camps. I was pretty vocal when this was being brought in 5-6 years ago in saying I didn't want it. So I don't feel I'm being after the event or using hindsight to say I told you so. And it gives me no pleasure to do so. But I just think that football is a game of human frailty. And that goes for the officials as well as the players. And that we've just added a layer of complication and a layer of frustration that wasn't there before now, because we were presented with VAR as a catch-all, mend-all, fix-all solution. And of course, it's not. And it was never going to be. So I just think we're in an awkward, frustrating place. And it's interesting, actually, talking to Peter Drury last week ahead of Arsenal, we were just discussing VAR, and I think both of us would probably do away with it, given the chance. But as commentators, the biggest frustration of all is that you can be going into the 95th minute of a rip-roaring Premier League, MLS game, doesn't matter what the competition is, but the game has gripped you for 90 minutes. And then you get the pinnacle moment, or so you think, in the 95th minute where someone goes upfield and scores the clinching goal. And you go doolally, and so do the crowd. And then 2 minutes later, after lengthy, mysterious delays over which there's very little communication, you find out that, in fact, what you've just seen and celebrated didn't actually happen at all. And I don't see how you can present professional entertainment in that manner. It's a bit like asking someone to pay an awful lot of money to go to a Broadway show. And there's a very intricate plot. And just as you get into the punchline at the end, the manager comes out, draws the curtains across and says, sorry, we're not going to tell you what happens. Because that's basically the equivalent, in a dramatic sense, to what's happening with VAR at the moment in a match deciding moment. And that can't be right.
Yeah. And when I think about it now that you say it, in terms of some of my best memories of football from over the decades that I've been following it, it's those moments where that goal goes into the back of the net. And the celebrations. For me, it would be Alan Curtis for Swansea City against Leeds United, August 1981, first game of the first division. And I was right there, right in the terracing, by in front of the fence, being kind of pinned in. But that moment will live with me forever. So if that was pulled back because of VAR was back in the day, I would have been just devastated, destroyed.
It's also the fact, Chris, that when that, put yourself in that position, say that game had VAR and you're there as that Swansea fan and that happens, you know, you were 100% all in on it, I presume, when that happened.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Now, as a fan, however rabid a fan, you'd only be 75% in because the first thought would be, hey, that's brilliant. And then the second thought, 2 seconds later, would be, hang on, is that actually going to count?
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Well, speaking of brilliant, John, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. It's been a pleasure catching up and really enjoyed the chat. And best of luck for the rest of the Premier League season with NBC Sports.
Thank you very much, Chris. It's always great to talk to you. Love World Soccer Talk. And thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, thank you.
Hi.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to another round of Boardroom or Miro Board. Today we talk retrospectives with Agile coach Maria. Let's go. First question. You've spent 2 hours in a team retro, but the only input you've heard is Dave's. Boardroom or Miro Board?
Boardroom. In Miro, Dave can't hog the space because everyone can add thoughts anonymously, online at the same time.
Correct. Next. You need the team to act on feedback fast, so you turn all those retro notes into Jira tasks instantly.
Miro all the way. And I can assign those tasks to teammates.
You're nailing this. Now, you see hundreds of sticky notes from the retro. A real mess. But you organize them into 5 themes in just seconds.
Miro, I basically get back an entire hour when I use its AI tools for clustering.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people running actually enjoyable and actionable retros in Miro. Get your first 3 boards free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.